This is the Poetry Foundation's Essential American Poets podcast. Essential American Poets is an online audio poetry collection. The poets in the collection were selected in 2006 by Donald Hall when he was poet laureate. Recordings of the poets he selected are available online at poetryfoundation.org and poetryarchive.org. In this edition of the podcast, we'll hear poems by Robert Pinsky. Robert Pinsky is known as a public or civic poet. In 1997, he was elected to the first of a record 3 terms as U.S. Poet Laureate, and his time there was marked by ambitious efforts to demonstrate the necessity of poetry in every part of American life. Robert Pinsky was born in 1940 in Long Branch, New Jersey. Pinsky recalls the town as decayed but still gaudy, with a glorious history where presidents summered along with Broadway stars, famous gamblers, and patent medicine millionaires. Pinsky's own father was an optician, and their apartment building was sandwiched between rooming houses. So Pinsky says his childhood neighbors were house painters, railroad workers, horse trainers, and a jockey or two. The experience had a lasting impact on Pinsky. He says he has respect and maybe some nostalgia for the practical knowledge of the world, for that earthly competence. Pinsky also says his work as a poet is an extension of his lifelong desire to make things. Pinsky earned his BA at Rutgers University and an MA and a PhD from Stanford University, where he studied under the poet Ivor Winters. Pinsky published his first book of poetry in 1975 and has since published many books of poetry, prose, and translation. The critic Willard Spiegelman says Pinsky's poetry and criticism has an abiding unity of which the principal ingredients are ethical ambition, sanity, a sense of humor, and something to say. Pinsky's 1996 book of collected poems, The Figured Wheel, received the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize. Pinsky's translation work with the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz also received wide acclaim, as did his 1994 translation of Dante's Inferno. Pinsky has received many other honors and awards, including a Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship, the William Carlos Williams Award, and the Shelley Memorial Prize. During his time as poet laureate, from 1997 until 2000, Pinsky launched the Favorite Poem Project, a nationwide effort to have Americans read and comment on their favorite poems. Pinsky has edited several anthologies based on the Favorite Poem Project. He's also edited a poetry column for Slate.com and has appeared on The Simpsons and The Colbert Report. Robert Pinsky lives with his wife in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and teaches at Boston University. The Poetry Foundation recorded the following poems at WBUR in Boston in 2007.
Shirt. The back. The yoke. The yardage. Lapped seams. The nearly invisible stitches along the collar turned in a sweatshop by Koreans or Malaysians gossiping over tea and noodles on their break or talking money or politics while one fitted this arm piece with its overseam to the band of cuff I button at my wrist. The presser. The cutter. The ringer. The mangle. The needle. The union. The treadle. The bobbin, the code, the infamous blaze at the Triangle Factory in 1911. 146 died in the flames on the 9th floor. No hydrants, no fire escapes. The witness in a building across the street who watched how a young man helped a girl to step up to the windowsill, then held her out away from the masonry wall and let her drop. And then another, as if he were helping them up to enter a streetcar, and not eternity. A third, before he dropped her, put her arms around his neck and kissed him. Then he held her into space and dropped her. Almost at once, he stepped to the sill himself. His jacket flared and fluttered up from his shirt as he came down, air filling up the legs of his gray trousers. Like Hart Crane's bedlamite, shrill shirt ballooning. Wonderful how the pattern matches perfectly across the placket and over the twin bar-tacked corners of both pockets, like a strict rhyme or a major chord. Prince, plaids, checks, houndstooth, tattersall, madras. The clan tartans invented by mill owners inspired by the hoax of Ossian to control their savage Scottish workers, tamed by a fabricated heraldry. McGregor, Bailey, McMartin. The kilt devised for workers to wear among the dusty clattering looms, weavers, carters, spinners, the loader, the docker, the navvy, the planter, the picker, the sorter sweating at her machine in a litter of cotton as slaves in calico head rags sweated in fields. George Herbert, your descendant is a black lady in South Carolina. Her name is Irma, and she inspected my shirt. Its color and fit and feel and its clean smell have satisfied both her and me. We have culled its cost and quality down to the buttons of simulated bone, the button holes, the sizing, the facing, the characters printed in black on neckband and tail, the shape, the label, the labor, the color, the shade, the shirt. Poem about people. The jaunty, crop-haired, graying women in grocery stores, their clothes boyish and neat, new mittens or clean sneakers, clean hands, hips not bad still, buying ice cream, steaks, soda, fresh melons, and soap. Or the big, balding young men in work shoes and green work pants, beer belly and white T-shirt, the porky walk back to the truck, polite. Possible to feel briefly like Jesus, a gust of diffuse tenderness crossing the dark spaces to where the dry self burrows or nests, something that stirs, watching the kinds of people on the street for a while. But how love falters and flags when anyone's difficult eyes come into focus, terrible gaze of a unique soul, its need unlovable. My friend in his divorced schoolteacher apartment, his own unsuspected paintings hung everywhere, which his wife kept in a closet, not, he says, that she wasn't perfectly right, or me mishearing my rock radio sing myself pity, quote, the angels wished him dead. End quote. All the hideous sudden stare of self, soul showing through like the lizard ancestry showing in the frontal gaze of a robin busy on the lawn. In the movies, when the sensitive young Jewish soldier nearly drowns trying to rescue the thrashing anti-Semitic bullies swimming across the river raked by Nazi fire, the awful part is the part truth. Hate my whole kind, but me, love me for myself. The weather changes in the black of night, and the dream wind bowling across the sopping open spaces of roads, golf courses, parking lots, flails a commotion in the dripping treetops, tries a half-rotten shingle or a down-hung branch, and we all dream it, the dark wind crossing the wide spaces between us. Poem of Disconnected Parts is written in closed couplets. It's meant to evoke some of the anger and confusion I feel when I read the newspaper. I hope the parts are not unconnected, but the jaggedness of the movement from one couplet to the next is meant to be expressive. Poem of Disconnected Parts. At Robben Island, the political prisoners studied. They coined the motto, each one, teach one. In Argentina, the torturers demanded the prisoners address them always as profesor. Many of my friends are moved by guilt, but I am a creature of shame, I am ashamed to say. Culture the lock, culture the key, imagination that calls the boiled sheep heads in the market, smileys. The first year at Guantanamo, Abdul Rahim Dost incised his Pashto poems into styrofoam cups. Quote, the Sangomo says, in our Zulu culture, we do not worship our ancestors. We consult them. End quote. Becky is abandoned in 1902, and Rose dies giving birth in 1924, and Sylvia falls in 1951. Still falling, still dying, still abandoned in 2006, still nothing finished among the descendants. "I support the war," says the comic. "It's just the troops I'm against. Can't stand those young people." Proud of the fallen, proud of her son, the bomber, ashamed of the government, skeptical. After the Klansman was found not guilty, one juror said she just couldn't vote to convict a pastor. Who do you write for? I write for dead people, for Emily Dickinson, for my grandfather. Quote, "The ancestors say the problem with your knees began in your feet. It could move up your back." End quote. But later, the Americans gave Dost not only paper and pen, but books. Hemingway, Dickens. Old Aegyptius said, "Whoever has called this assembly, for whatever reason, that is a good in itself." O thirsty shades who regard the offering, O stained earth, there are many fake Sangomos. This one is real. Colored prisoners got different meals and could wear long pants and underwear. Blacks got only shorts. No, he says, he cannot regret the 3 years in prison. Otherwise, he would not have written those poems. I have a small town mind, like the Greeks and Trojans. Shame, pride, importance of looking bad or good. Did he see anything like the prisoner on a leash? Yes, in Afghanistan. In Guantanamo, he was isolated. Our enemies disassemble, says the president. Not that anyone at all couldn't misspeak. The professores created nicknames for torture devices. The airplane. The frog. Burping the baby. Not that those who behead the helpless in the name of God or tradition don't also write poetry. Guilts. Metaphors. Traditions, hunger strikes, culture the penalty, culture the escape. What could your children boast about you? What will your father say down among the shades? The Sangomo told Marvin, "You are crushed by some weight. Only your own ancestors can help you." Impossible to Tell is an elegy for my friend Elliot Gilbert, who loved telling jokes and knew a million of them. And at about the same time that Elliot died, through the blunder the doctors made, they made a mistake, they didn't detect their mistake, then they lied about their mistake. That was the end of Elliot. At about the same time that we in Berkeley were grieving that, my friend Bob Haas was finishing his wonderful anthology of haiku. And I was reading Bob's introduction, which really made me understand haiku for the first time. Among other things, it's part of a social evening, part of a longer renga, a collaborative form where people inspire one another to contribute stanzas. And this is what people do who tell jokes. Impossible to Tell. To Robert Haas and in memory of Elliot Gilbert. Slow dulcimer, gavotte and bow. In autumn, Basho and his friends go out to view the moon. In summer, gasoline rainbow and the gutter, the secret courtesy that courses like ichor through the old form of the rude, full-scale joke, impossible to tell in writing. Basho, he named himself. Banana tree. Banana after the plant some grateful students gave him, maybe in appreciation of his guidance, threading a long night through the rules and channels of their collaborative linking poem, scored in their teacher's heart, live, rigid, fluid, like passages etched in a microscopic circuit. Eliot had in his memory so many jokes they seemed to breed like microbes in a culture inside his brain, one so much making another it was impossible to tell them all. In the court culture of jokes, a top banana. Imagine a court of one, the queen a young mother, unhappy, alone all day with her firstborn child and her new baby in a squalid apartment of too few rooms, a different race from her neighbors. She tells the child she's going to kill herself. She broods. She rages. Hoping to distract her, the child cuts capers. He sings. He does imitations of different people in the building. He jokes. He feels if he keeps her alive until the father gets home from work, they'll be okay till morning. It's laughter versus the bedroom and the pills. What is he in his efforts but a courtier? Impossible to tell his whole delusion. In the first months when I had moved back east from California and had to leave a message on Bob's machine, I used to make a habit of telling the tape a joke. And partway through, I would pretend that I forgot the punchline or make believe that I was interrupted, as though he'd be so eager to hear the end he'd have to call me back. The joke was Eliot's more often than not. The doctors made the blunder that killed him sometime later that same year. One day, when I got home, I found a message on my machine from Bob. He had a story about two rabbis, one of them tall, one short. One day, while walking along the street together, they see the corpse of a Chinese man before them, and Bob said, "Sorry, he forgot the rest." Of course, he thought that his joke was a dummy, impossible to tell, a dead-end challenge. But here it is, as Eliot told it to me. The dead man's widow came to the rabbis weeping, begging them, if they could, to resurrect him. Shocked, the tall rabbi said absolutely not, but the short rabbi told her to bring the body into the study house and ordered the shutters closed so the room was night dark. Then he prayed over the body, chanting a secret blessing out of Kabbalah. "Arise and breathe," he shouted. But nothing happened. The body lay still. So then the little rabbi called for hundreds of candles and danced around the body, chanting and praying in Hebrew, then Yiddish, then Aramaic. He prayed in Turkish and Egyptian and Old Galician for nearly 3 hours, leaping about the coffin in the candlelight so that his tiny black shoes seemed not to touch the floor. With one last prayer, sobbed in the Spanish of before the Inquisition, he stopped, exhausted, and looked in the dead man's face. Panting, he raised both arms in a mystic gesture and said, "Arise and breathe." And still the body lay as before. Impossible to tell in words how Eliot's eyebrows flailed and snorted like shaggy mammoths as, the Chinese widow granting permission, the little rabbi sang the blessing for performing a circumcision and removed the dead man's foreskin, chanting blessings in Finnish and Swahili, and bathed the corpse from head to foot, and with a final prayer in Babylonian, gasping with exhaustion, he seized the dead man's head and kissed the lips and dropped it again and, leaping back, commanded, "Arise and breathe." The corpse lay still as ever. At this, as when Basho's disciples wind along the curving spine that links the Renga across the different voices, each voice adding a transformation according to the rules of stasis and repetition, all in order and yet impossible to tell beforehand, Eliot changes for the punchline. The wee rabbi, still panting like a startled boxer, looks at the dead one, then up at all those watching, a kind of Mel Brooks gesture. "Who boy," he says, "now that's what I call really dead." O mortal powers and princes of earth, and you immortal lords of the underground and afterlife, Jehovah, Ra, Bolmora, Hecate, Pluto, what has a brilliant living soul to do with your harps and fires and boats, your bric-a-brac and troughs of smoking blood? provincial stinkers. Our languages don't touch you. You're like that mother whose small child entertained her to beg her life. Possibly he grew up to be the tall rabbi, the one who washed his hands of all those capers right at the outset. Or maybe he became the author of these lines, a one-man ringa, the one for whom it seems to be impossible to tell a story straight. It was a routine procedure. When it was finished, the physicians told Sandra and the kids it had succeeded, but Elliot wouldn't wake up for maybe an hour. They should go eat. The two of them loved to bicker in a way that on his side went back to Yiddish, on Sandra's to some Sicilian dialect. He used to scold her endlessly for smoking. When she got back from dinner with their children, the doctors had to tell them about the mistake. Oh, swirling petals. Oh, falling leaves. The movement of linking ringa coursing from moment to moment is meaning, Bob says in his haiku book. Oh, swirling petals, all living things are contingent. Oh, falling leaves and transient, and they suffer. But the universal is the goal of jokes, especially certain ethnic jokes, which taper down through the swirling funnel of tongues and gestures toward their preposterous Ithaca. There's one a journalist told me. He heard it while a hero of the South African freedom movement was speaking to elderly Jews. The speaker's own right arm had been blown off by right-wing letter bombers. He told his listeners they had to cast their ballots for the ANC, a group the old Jews feared as in with the Arabs. But they started weeping as the old one-armed fighter told them their country needed them to vote for what was right. Their vote could make a country their children could return to from London and Chicago. The moved old people applauded wildly, and the speaker's friend whispered to the journalist, "It's the Belgian army joke come to life. I wish that I could tell it to Elliot." In the Belgian army, the feud between the Flemings and Walloons grew vicious, so out of hand the army could barely function. Finally, one commander assembled his men in one great room to deal with things directly. They stood before him at attention. "All Flemings," he ordered, "to the left wall." Half the men clustered to the left. "Now all Walloons," he ordered, "move to the right." An equal number crowded against the right wall. Only one man remained at attention in the middle. "What are you, soldier?" Saluting, the man said, "Sir, I am a Belgian." "Why, that's astonishing, corporal. What's your name?" Saluting again, "Rabinowitz," he answered. A joke that seems at first to be a story about the Jews. But as the ringa describes religious meaning by moving and drifting petals and brittle leaves that touch and die and suffer the changing winds that riffle the gutter swirl, so in the joke, just under the raucous music of Fleming, Jew, Walloon, a courtly allegiance moves to the dulcimer, gavotte and bow, over the banana tree, the moon in autumn, allegiance to a state impossible to tell. The hearts. The legendary muscle that wants and grieves. The organ of attachment. The pump of thrills and troubles, clinging in stubborn colonies like pulpy shore life battened on a jetty. Slashed by the little deaths of sleep and pleasure, they swell in the nurturing spasms of the waves, sucking to cling, and even in death itself, baked, frozen, they shrink to grip the granite harder. Rid yourself of attachments and aversions. But in her father's orchard already, he says he'd like to be her bird, and she says, "Sweet, yes, yet I should kill thee with much cherishing," showing that she knows already, as Art Pepper, that first time he takes heroin, already knows that he will go to prison, and that he'll suffer, and knows he needs to have it or die. And the one who makes the general lose the world for love lets him say, "Would I had never seen her, But oh, says Enobarbus, then you would have missed a wonderful piece of work, which left unseen would bring less glory to your travels. Among us creatures in the rock-torn surf, a wave of agitation, a gasp. A scholar quips, Shakespeare was almost certainly homosexual, bisexual, or heterosexual. The sonnets provide no evidence on the matter. He writes Romeo an extravagant speech on tears in the Italian manner. His teardrops cover his chamber window, says the boy. He calls them crystals, inanely, and sings them to Juliet with his heart. The almost certainly invented heart, which Buddha denounces in its endless changes, forever jumping and moving like an ape. Over the poor ape's head, the crystal fountain crashes illusions, the cold salt spume of pain and meaningless distinction, as Buddha says. But here, in the crystal shower, mouths are open to sing. It is Lee Andrews and the Hearts in 1957 singing, I sit in my room looking out at the rain. My teardrops are like crystals. They cover my window pane. The turns of these illusions we make become their glory. To Buddha, every distinct thing is illusion, and becoming is destruction. But still we sing in the shower. I do. In the beginning, God drenched the emptiness with images. The potter, cross-legged at his wheel in Benares Market, making mud cups, another cup each second tapering up between his fingers, one more to sell the tea seller at a penny a dozen, and tea a penny a cup. The customers smash the empties, and waves of traffic grind the shards to mud for new cups in turn. And I keep a cup here next to me, holding it a while, from out of the cloud of dust that rises from the shattered pieces, the risen dust alive with fire, then settled and soaked and whirling again on the wheel that turns and looks on the world as on another cloud, on everything the heart can grasp and throw away as a passing cloud. With even enlightenment, itself another image, another cloud to break and churn a salt foam over the heart like an anemone that sucks at clouds and makes itself with clouds and sings in clouds and covers its window pane with clouds that blur and melt until one clings and holds. As once in the temple, in the time before the temple was destroyed, a young priest saw the seraphim of the Lord. Each had six wings. With two they covered their faces. With two they covered their legs and feet. With two they darted and hovered like dragonflies, or perched like griffins in the shadows near the ceiling. These are the visions, too barbarous for heaven, and too preposterous for belief on earth, God sends to taunt his prophet with the truth no one can see that leads to who knows where. A seraph took a live coal from the altar and seared the prophet's lips, and so he spoke. As the record ends, a coda in retard, the hearts in a shifting velvety ah and ah prolonged again, and again, as Lee Andrews reaches, ah, high, for I have to gain faith, hope, and charity. God only knows the girl who will love me. Oh, if we only could start over again. Then the hearts chant the chords again a final time, ah, and the record turns through all the music and on into silence again.
That was Robert Pinsky, recorded at WBUR in Boston in 2007. The poems are used by permission of HarperCollins. You have been listening to the Essential American Poets podcast, produced by the Poetry Foundation in collaboration with PoetryArchive.org. To learn more about Robert Pinsky and other Essential American Poets, and to hear more poetry, go to PoetryFoundation.org.